Welcome to Nowhere to Run with Christopher White.
What's up? Thank you for tuning in. That was Hosanna from Hillsong United at the beginning. It's a really cool song. It's an even cooler video if you get a chance to check it out. I posted that as a video on the New Revelations Radio Network, sort of like social network thing that's going on there, which if you haven't seen already is a good thing to go do. Go to revelationsradionetwork.com and check out the new social network. You can set up a profile there, but you can also connect. Like if you have a Facebook account, you can sort of connect it to that somehow, and Twitter, or I don't know. There's all kinds of things that you can do with it. It's very fun. So check that out if you haven't. But I posted that video to that song on there just now, as well as a few other videos. One that I'll actually be playing a little later on, just a little 5-minute clip. So you can get a hold of me through that site, revelationsradionetwork.com, and click on my profile and send me a message there, or you can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com. Okay, moving on here. I haven't been doing that many shows lately, and I know I keep doing shows where I say I'm about to start doing more shows, but then that never happens. I think it's like if you have ever bought like a journal at a bookstore, a really nice, you know, journal with blank pages, and then you never write in it because you only want to write like super cool thoughts in it since it's such a cool journal. Anyway, I think it's something around that same sort of idea is the reason I haven't been posting a lot of shows. But anyway, I do plan on trying to do a lot more, and we'll see how that goes. Okay, let's get into some specific things. The first is something that I really want y'all to check out, and it's the 2012 presentation that I just did. It's a video that I've posted it on the Revelations Radio Network thing under my videos. If you go to my profile, it's like the first video that I posted. You can also see this on any of my YouTube pages, which is youtube.com/nowheretorun1984 or the 2012deception.net. If you know anybody that is concerned about 2012 or anything about 2012, please check this out, because I think it's just about as clear of a presentation. It's like everything that I wanted to say about a lot of different things all in one place. And so I feel very strongly that it was something I was supposed to do. In fact, I felt that I should do this for a while, but I didn't. And then just a few different things made me think, okay, I better do this. And when I did, there was about 3 or 4 days there that it was probably the worst sort of spiritual attack that I'd ever had. It was weird. I was like getting really emotional about ridiculous. I could never even put my finger on it. I couldn't say this is why I'm upset and depressed. I could never say this is why. It was just like intense, and everything was going wrong with, but it all stopped once I got it out. I mean, and it was like everything that could go wrong technically did. I mean, it wasn't impossible, but it wasn't It was the hardest thing that I've ever done as far as that goes. And I could have just been a really bad technical day for me or whatever. But anyway, I do think it's a really good presentation. And if you get a chance, please go to the 2012deception.net. It's a good place to see it. And I want to thank specifically Angela who's part of the, you know, she's part of the Revelations Radio Network family over there. And you can see her profile on the revelationsradionetwork.com social network that's going on. She helped me with the PowerPoint presentation. You should have seen my PowerPoint presentation versus hers was just, I guess that she does that for her job, or at least part of what her job is. And it's just ridiculously awesome. So, I mean, totally owe the clarity of that whole thing to her. In fact, she fixed all the mistakes that I made, and she just went really above and beyond and made that basically what it is. So I just thank her a lot for that. And I think that the response has been great from that so far, but I just haven't got it to as many people. And so after I get done with the show, my intention is to go around and try to create some controversy somewhere on the boards. I haven't really done that very much lately, which is go to conspiracy boards and make people think about stuff that they don't want to think about. So we'll try to do that later in the night. Another thing that I want to talk about is I just met Keith Truth yesterday. He came, or Keith Thompson. We've interviewed him here on the show. He's also a like-minded individual on YouTube. A lot of you out there know who I'm talking about. And he has been making a documentary about you know, the infiltration of the truth movement. We've played bits and pieces of that here, but just from a totally fresh angle, and he's got a lot more research into it and is really planning on doing a really good job with it. It was really cool to be able to meet him, and we filmed at the Parthenon in Nashville, which is a recreation of, the Parthenon. And we didn't go in it because it was Sunday at the time, but it was it's just a huge monument to Athena. I mean, they've literally got like this massive statue to Athena inside there, like plated in gold and everything. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm sure that's nothing really nefarious goes on in there. But anyway, the interview was great, and I hope it turns out okay, and I hope that I was able to say insightful things. Honestly, I didn't really feel like I was being all that insightful, but I hope it turns out good. Okay, also, this is a really cool thing. Derek Talley, who does Online House Church and from Spiritualized Ministry Bible Study Podcast here on the Revelations Radio Network, he did a lot of work for DVD Tract in the Harvest Project. He put together this, like, huge theological refutation of, like, every, you know, all these heresies. I mean, it's like the research that he did was, I mean, unbelievable. You almost have to see it to believe it. And it's not totally finished, but huge chunks of it are finished. And it's vast is the best word to describe it. And he's also done an audio that he'll probably play as a podcast pretty soon of a short version of that. And it's just really amazing to listen to just from a Bible study perspective, because he really gets in there and shows without a doubt things like the deity of Christ and the Trinity and things like that. Also, it's helpful just to see for yourself, and if you want to do that, you can go to dvdtrack.com and go to the part about Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, and there at the bottom is this huge list that you can kind of interact with and click and go to the places where the notes are, and it has links to download the audio and also the notes to that particular bit of audio. So a lot of thanks to Derek for his help in that, and if you know any Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, certainly that site, dvdtrack.com, will show you how to burn either the audio or video of any of those particular ones and to hand them out to your friends. Also, the regular DVD tract on the main page, the home page there, is also available for download to do that as well. All right, I want to talk real quick about the Book of Enoch. Now, I read the Book of Enoch for the first time all the way through the last few days, and I've done some research that the research was sparked out of reading certain things in the Book of Enoch that just intrigued me, so I started looking at some other stuff, and basically it came to just some inconclusive results in a lot of this, but nevertheless I think it's interesting, an interesting start to something. Maybe somebody else can pick it up where I left off. But let me first say that before, when I would hear people say stuff about the Book of Enoch, even though I understood all the ideas that, you know, it was quoted in the Bible, that Jude quotes from it, and Peter, you know, mentions it as well. So I understood that, you know, it was at least, it was read by the early church fathers and agreed that it was prophecy, as Jude says. So I knew that at least certain parts of it were inspired. And I'm not saying that the entire thing was, or I'm not saying that it should be in the Bible. Please don't misunderstand me. I know that a lot of people actually will actually just write entire websites about you as soon as you mention it. It's like, can you believe he, you know, is mentioning the Book of Enoch or whatever? But anyway, I would say I don't want to go into the history of it. You can go find out about that on your own. I would recommend you just searching, Google searching on the history of it, read the Wikipedia, you know, get a good start on it. The best presentation I've seen about why it should be taken seriously by a Christian, at least for historical purposes, is Guy Malone, and he did a presentation at like one of the first Ancient of Days conferences. So you could find Guy Malone, the Book of Enoch, or something like that. And he gives a pretty thorough presentation. I saw that a while back, and I was like, really? All that stuff's in there? That's pretty intense. Specifically, what's so interesting about this is that is the view of Christ in this book, the Book of Enoch. It seems to read more like the Book of Revelation than a book that was supposedly written by Enoch, the seventh from Adam. And, in fact, listen to the way Jude quotes Enoch. He says, "And Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints." And it goes on to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that are ungodly among them. Now, there's a lot of things implied in that quote that Jude quotes. First, that it was actually, the actual seventh from Adam, Enoch, he prophesied. And this was his prophecy. It was about Jesus. It was about the second coming of Christ. And it was, this is a guy who could have prophesied about the first coming of Christ, but instead the first prophecy that anybody prophesied was about the second coming of Christ. And you'll see really quickly, I'm going to play a few minutes from the very opening of the Book of Enoch. You're going to see that this is a book that was, even by outright from the inception, it's like, this is for a remote generation way, way, way in the future. What's going on is that it's telling everybody that a judgment is one is coming, that we all are going to be accountable for our sins. Right from the beginning, God says to everybody, we're all going to be accountable for our sins. Let me just go ahead and play about 2 minutes of the opening of the Book of Enoch so you get an idea of how this sounds if you've never heard it before. One thing that I found while listening to this whole thing was, you know, it didn't offend one single doctrinal point that I had. I mean, I listened to the whole thing and I'm waiting for, okay, where's the crazy doctrine coming? And it's talking really specific doctrine. I mean, it talks about, you know, the deity of Christ, the, you know, that Christ existed before the beginning of time. It's like all these doctrinal points are just sort of highlighted with the Book of Enoch. That happens with, you know, point after point after point, but it never offended a doctrinal position that I know and understand to be true. And before I play this clip, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the Book of Enoch is infallible. I'm not saying that it should have been in the Bible. I'm just saying that there are certain parts of it that clearly the Bible calls us to pay attention to. And so it's those parts that we're going to be paying attention to specifically in this just sort of overview. But I did want to give you a taste of how it reads, so I'm going to play the very beginning of it right here.
The Book of Enoch. The words of the blessing of Enoch, wherewith he blessed the elect and righteous, who will be living in the day of tribulation, when all the wicked and godless are to be removed. And he took up this parable and said, Enoch, a righteous man, whose eyes were opened by God, saw the vision of the Holy One in the heavens, which the angels showed me. And from them I heard everything, and from them I understood as I saw. But not for this generation, but for a remote one which is for to come. Concerning the elect, I said, and took up my parable concerning them. The Holy Great One will come forth from his dwelling, and the Eternal God will tread upon the earth, even on Mount Sinai, and appear from his camp, and appear in the strength of his might from the heaven of heavens. And all shall be smitten with fear, and the watchers shall quake, and great fear and trembling shall seize them unto the ends of the earth. And the high mountain shall be shaken, and the high hills shall be made low, and shall melt like wax before the flame. And the earth shall be wholly rent and sunder, and all that is upon the earth shall perish, and there shall be a judgment upon all men. But with the righteous he will make peace, and will protect the elect, and mercy shall be upon them. And they shall all belong to God, and they shall be prospered, and they shall all be blessed. And he will help them all. And light shall appear unto them, and he will make peace with them. And behold, he cometh with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all, and to destroy all the ungodly, and to convict all flesh of all the works of their ungodliness which they have ungodly committed, and of all the hard things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him.
And in fact, that whole quote is quoted in Jude. He actually goes on to say, coming with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. That's how the all that Jude quotes, including the 10,000s of the saints part. Now, also, this little book of Jude, just to me, it's obvious that Jude was talking so much about what the book of Enoch was talking about. So much of this book, like he says here, and the angels was kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation and hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Now, that's an absolute quote from the book of Enoch, which I'm going to show you here in just a second, because that's part of the part I'm showing this to you for, is that line, verse 6 in Jude, and the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, and this part, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the great judgment of the great day. Those the last parts is clearly part of the book of Enoch, or at least the Holy Spirit has called Jude to remember something that maybe he didn't read. But either way, it is connected in idea way too close, as we'll see here in a minute, to not actually be referring to the same events. And for the millionth time, I don't really want to make a big deal about this. I'm not saying that this is something that we need to pay an extra close attention to. I just want to float the theory here that just what this book says at the beginning, that this is for a remote generation, those that are in the tribulation. And so it's possible, and this is just a theory, that this book or parts of this book are supposed to help those in this last time dealing with something that they're going to have to deal with that a lot of other people wouldn't know what to do with and have no use for. Let's say if there was some great deception that was going to come on the world that is so great that it could deceive the very elect, these kind of epic proportion things that are going to happen, this book sort of gives it the play-by-play. What's so interesting, what I'm about to do is I'm about to play a section from the book of Enoch that really deals with the fallen angels themselves and how they came down and what they did and these kinds of things. And what I want you to notice is that if you've studied the Nephilim from a purely biblical perspective, this won't be any different than anything that you believe. It is going to be exactly everything that you've known from your studies in the Bible about the Nephilim. But what's interesting is that it sort of gives you a much clearer picture of what went down. So I'm going to play this a few 5-minute clip, and I want to highlight a few things, and we're going to move on to something that else after this, but there's some interesting theories that I want to propose after I play this. So here I go. Here is a few. Now, it's going to call this right at the beginning a fragment from the book of Noah. There are some subtle hints in this book that Noah was at least penning some of it. There's about 5 books that we collectively call the Book of Enoch, but there is a lot of speculation that Noah physically penned some of this down, because there's one part where he says, he's talking about this, and he's talking about Enoch, his grandfather. You know, my grandfather, Enoch, that would be Noah. But anyway, I'll stop rambling and just play the clip.
A fragment from the Book of Noah. And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of the heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children. And Shemjaza was their leader, and said unto them, I fear you will not indeed agree to do this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin. And they all answered him and said, Let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations, not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing. Then swear they all together, and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And they were in all 200 who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon, and they called it Mount Hermon, because they had sworn and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And these are the names of their leaders: Shemjaz, their leader, Arakiba, Ramael, Kokabeel, Tamiel, Ramiel, Daniel, Ezekiel, Barakihol, Asael, Anmaros, Batareel, Ananel, Zakiel, Samsapael, Satarel, Turel, Jomjael, Sarael. These are the chiefs of tens. And all the others, together with them, took unto themselves wives, and each chose for himself one. And they began to go in unto them, and to defile themselves with them. And they taught them charms, and enchantments, and the cutting of roots, and made them acquainted with plants. And they became pregnant, and bare great giants, whose height was 3,000 ells, who consumed all the acquisitions of men. And when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them, and devoured mankind. And they began to sin against birds, and beasts, and reptiles, and fish, and to devour one another's flesh, and to drink the blood. Then the earth laid accusation against the lawless ones. And Azazel taught men to make swords, and knives, and shields, and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth, and the art of working them, and bracelets, and ornaments, and the use of antimony, and the beautifying of the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones, and all coloring tinctures. And there arose much godlessness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray, and became corrupt in all their ways. Simjaza taught enchantments and root cuttings, Armoros the resolving of enchantments, Barakihal taught astrology, Kokabel the constellations, Ezekiel the knowledge of the clouds, Arakiel the signs of the earth, Shamsiel the signs of the sun, and Sariel the course of the moon. And as men perished, they cried, and their cry went up to heaven. And then Michael, Uriel, Raphael, and Gabriel looked down from heaven and saw much blood being shed upon the earth, and all lawlessness being wrought upon the earth. And they said to one another, "The earth, made without inhabitant, cries the voice of their crying up to the gates of heaven. And now to you, the holy ones of heaven, the souls of men make their suit, saying, Bring our cause before the Most High. And they said to the Lord of the ages, Lord of lords, God of gods, King of kings, and God of the ages, the throne of thy glory standeth unto all the generations of the ages, and thy name holy and glorious and blessed unto all the ages. Thou hast made all things, and power over all things hast thou, and all things are naked and open in thy sight, and thou seest all things, and nothing can hide itself from thee. Thou seest what Azazel has done, who hath taught all unrighteousness on earth, and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. And Simjaza, to whom thou hast given authority to bear rule over his associates, and they have gone unto the daughters of men upon the earth, and have slept with the women, and have defiled themselves, and revealed to them all kinds of sins. And the women have borne giants, and the whole earth has thereby been filled with blood and unrighteousness. And now, behold, the souls of those who have died are crying and making their suit to the gates of heaven, and their lamentations have ascended, and cannot cease because of the lawless deeds which are wrought on the earth. And thou knowest all things before they come to pass, and thou seest these things, and thou dost suffer them, and thou dost not say to us what we are to do to them in regard to these. Then said the Most High, the Holy and Great One, spake, and sent Uriel to the son of Lamech, and said to him, Go to Noah, and tell him in my name, Hide thyself, and reveal to him the end that is approaching, that the whole world will be destroyed, and a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth, and will destroy all that is on it. And now instruct him that he may escape, and his seed may be preserved for all generations of the world. And again the Lord said to Raphael, Bind Azazel hand and foot, and cast him into the darkness, and make an opening in the desert, which is in Dudael, and cast him therein. And place upon him rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever, and cover his face, that he may not see light, and on the day of the great judgment he shall be cast into the fire. And heal the earth, which the angels have corrupted, and proclaim the healing of the earth, that they may heal the plague, and that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things that the watchers have disclosed and taught their sons. And the whole earth has been corrupted through the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin. And to Gabriel said the Lord, proceed against the bastards and the reprobates, and against the children of fornication, and destroy the children of fornication and the children of the watchers from amongst men, and cause them to go forth. Send them one against the other, that they may destroy each other in battle. For length of days shall they not have. And no request that their fathers make of thee shall be granted unto them on their behalf. For they hope to live an eternal life, and that each one of them will live 500 years. And the Lord said unto Michael, go, bind Shimshazah and his associates who have united themselves with women so as to have defiled themselves with them in all their uncleanness. And when their sons have slain one another, and they have seen the destruction of their beloved ones, bind them fast for 70 generations in the valleys of the earth, till the day of judgment and of their consummation, till the judgment that is for ever and ever is consummated. In those days they shall be led off to the abyss of fire, and to the torment and the prison in which they shall be confined for ever. And whosoever shall be condemned and destroyed will from thenceforth be bound together with them to the end of all generations, and destroy all the spirits of the reprobate and the children of the watchers, because they have wronged mankind. Destroy wrong from the face of the earth, and let every evil work come to an end, and let the plant of righteousness and truth appear, and it shall prove a blessing. The works of righteousness and truth shall be planted in truth and joy forevermore. And then shall all the righteous escape, and shall live till they beget thousands of children, and all the days of their youth and their old age shall be completed in peace. And then shall the whole earth be tilled in righteousness, and shall all be planted with trees, and be full of blessing, and all desirable trees shall be planted on it, and they shall plant vines on it, and the vine which they plant thereon shall yield wine in abundance. And as for all the seed which is sown thereon, each measure of it shall bear 1,000, and each measure of olive shall yield 10 presses of oil. And cleanse thou the earth from all oppression, and from all unrighteousness, and from all sin, and from all godlessness, and all uncleanness that is wrought upon the earth, destroy from off the earth. And all the children of men shall become righteous, and all nations shall offer adoration and praise me, and all shall worship me. And the earth shall be cleansed from all defilement, and from all sin, and from all punishment, and from all torment, and I will never again send them upon it from generation to generation forever. And in those days I will open the store chambers of blessing which are in the heaven, so as to send them down upon the earth over the work and labor of the children of men, and truth and peace shall be associated together throughout all the days of the world, and throughout all the generations of men. End of the fragment.
Okay, there's a lot of stuff to talk about there. Just if anybody's wondering where I'm getting this audio, is actually a guy on YouTube that is reading those. I actually tried to find some good audio for the Book of Enoch, but I was unable to find anything really good. This guy online does a really good job of it, but I haven't converted all the 27 parts. I've only converted like 2 parts to MP3. Just for these purposes of this podcast, but you could probably, I've actually emailed him and asked if I could have a link to the full audio, but I found another piece of audio somewhere else, that was really, really bad. But anyway, so there's lots of stuff that we could talk about. I do think that a lot of that connects to the Bible in certain ways. I don't want to make a big deal about it for the 100th time. I don't think this is, canonical or whatever, but, one of the specific things I wanted to talk about was this particular line right here.
And again the Lord said to Raphael, bind Azazel hand and foot, and cast him into the darkness, and make an opening in the desert, which is in Dudael, and cast him therein. And place upon him rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever. And cover his face, that he may not see light, and on the day of the great judgment he shall be cast into the fire.
And actually, they go on to talk of this, basically the same thing with Shimshazah and his associates, as it says. But it obviously echoes Jude and other places here, the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, and he hath reserved in everlasting chains unto darkness, unto the judgment of the great day. So here's the key part, is that they are locked up somewhere right now, but when the great day of judgment comes, they're going to be thrown into the fire forever. Now, I don't think that there's any room in here for these guys getting let loose, you know, like for somebody trying, maybe somebody will attempt to let them loose or whatever, but none of the passage in Jude or the passage of Enoch allow for any of these guys getting out of these chains. They may or may not have influence. It makes this thing that in Dudael, this is where Azazel was thrown, that he was thrown jagged rocks on top of him and bound hand and foot, where and put darkness over him where he couldn't see. Whether or not he can have other kinds of influence, I don't know. That's to me an enigmatic idea, but I really don't know. Now, when I first heard this, I was thinking, okay, jagged rocks on top of him. What about the pyramids? You know, my first idea, jagged rocks, pyramids. You know, I've always trying to figure out what the, you know, the pyramids are. And so I started looking around for that. And there is some connection to Egypt with this idea, although I don't think enough. To be honest, the word Dudael is really hard etymologically to figure out where they're talking about. It talks about in this desert where Dudael was, is where they dug a hole and threw him in and put jagged rocks on top. Now, the jagged rocks idea had a lot to do with the name Azazel was to do with the Azazel goat, which in the Old Testament they would put the sins on, and then they would put him out in a specific part outside the city of Jerusalem where there were jagged rocks. And so there's like a play on words going on there too. So it may be that this is somewhere in Jerusalem. There's other speculation that the term Dudael comes from this sort of the way early people referred to these twin peaks in Babylon. But it's really kind of hard to explain why that was, just from an etymological perspective. At the end of the day, I don't think that it was associated with that. I'd have no idea where Dudael is, and I don't know if we're supposed to know or whatever. The main thing, I think, here is that there are these guys and that they were buried. Now, it's my opinion that it's possible that if not Azazel here or anybody else, I think that this concept is clear that it happened for at least a few of these guys. They were bound somewhere in a geographical location. Now, Dudael was for Azazel. Samjaza was presumably somewhere else. I think, whether it's under the pyramids or whatever, I think that some of this happened in Egypt. And the reason, mostly, is because of Egyptian religion. Now, Egyptian religion is a lot like other religions. Men kept adding a whole bunch of stuff over the years. The Egyptians reigned for a long, long time. So their version of sort of this underworld in Egyptian really changed a lot from the early days of what the underworld was all about. You know, once it started becoming more affordable for rich people to buy, you know, tickets to with coffins and all these kinds of things, then, you know, it really started being about like, okay, you go here and you say this to this talking snake and you keep going down and, you know, eventually you'll get to the underworld. But it's this consistent theme of the underworld that I think is based on truth. I think like many myths and legends, like they're based on a kernel of truth. And I think the reason that the Egyptians were so focused on this underworld in Egypt that the gods were, I think that's because that's what was going on. I think that, and in fact, you start to look at what they were talking about this, and I need to pull up my notes here real quick. Okay, I'm going to propose the idea that the Egyptians knew that God did this, that he threw these angels that sinned and bound them in chains, their headlong with their forelegs in chains, and that he put them in some locality near or around Egypt. And I think that this idea was a part of the ancient Egyptians' understanding from very, very early on but that it was corrupted over time and a lot of things added to it, and it became part of a mythology and a lot of stuff. It basically turned into a big game of telephone that was almost unrecognizable by the end. I'm going to read something from the Book of the Dead. This is called A Hymn of Praise to Ra when he riseth in the eastern part of heaven. And the last line, a few four or five sentences into it, is what's the most important part. It says, "Ascribe ye praise to Ra, the Lord of heaven, the King, the life, the strength, and health, the maker of the gods. Give ye thanks unto him in his beneficent form, which is enthroned in the Atet boat. Beings celestial praise thee, beings terrestrial praise thee. Thoth and the goddess Mot mark out thy course for thee day by day and every day. Thine enemy, the serpent, hath been given over to the fire. The serpent fiend, Sabu, hath fallen headlong, his forelegs are bound in chains, and his hind legs hath Ra carried away from him. The sons of revolt shall never more rise up." Okay, that's pretty interesting, I think. First, I think the sons of revolt and this idea of being bound in chains is straight from the Bible when it says, "The angels which kept not their first estate but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains." And it also corresponds with the obviously corresponding passage in the Book of Enoch, which says, "The Lord said to Raphael, bind Azazel hand and foot and cast him into darkness and make the opening in the desert which is in Judea and cast him therein and place upon him rough and jagged rocks and cover him with darkness and let him abide." So the idea that his feet and hands are bound, and actually even the idea that Raphael is binding him here is interesting, because Raphael has another connection directly to Egypt as far as the demons go, his function in sort of dealing with demons. And that comes from the Book of Tobit. The Book of Tobit is another ancient book. It's another apocryphal book. I'm not going to try to tell you it's quoted anywhere in the Bible or that you should read it or anything. But just from a historical perspective, there's a connection here, too. It says, let's see here, I'm going to read from a book here. It says, "In the Book of Tobit, an apocryphal text, Raphael chases a demon called Asmodeus from Persia, where the demon was engaged in tormenting a girl and slaying her would-be lovers. On its own volition, the demon flees straight to Egypt, where it is caught by Raphael, and there in Egypt, Asmodeus is bound and chained." So the question being, why would a demonic entity flee to Egypt? What protection might a spiritual being have there? Here is another quote from an Egyptian source from the Papyrus of Neket in the British Museum, number 10471, sheet 22. Now, we'll be looking for two things here. Rostow is where this place apparently is. This place calls it Shetate Shrine in Rostow. And also, we'll be looking at this idea of Sebu fiends. This sort of plural Sebu, S-E-B-A-U, is also significant, because I think even though they change names a lot, this is a significant one. It says, "I open the hidden water springs from the absolutions of Urit-Ab. I unbolt the door of the Shetite shrine in Rostu. I am with Horus as the protector of the left shoulder of Osiris, the dweller in Sekhem. I enter in among, and I came forth from the flame gods on the day of destruction of the Sebu fiends in Sekhem." Now, this is really interesting. If you read the Book of Enoch, when Enoch is going around and he's being shown all this stuff in heaven, and he's like, "What is that?" And it really looks like it's talking about a black hole. Maybe I'll play that here in a minute, but they're saying these seven flaming gods are that's what happened. Those in their prison, essentially, they look like big balls of fire. So that's a really weird tie-in, but it certainly ties into the flame gods and the day of destruction of the Sebu fiends in Sekhem. So that's another interesting tie-in. Even that word Sekhem that it uses there is used most of the time as a scepter, but kind of going through Egyptian etymology, I'll just read you what the sort of etymology of Sekhem is. It's many types of batons and scepters share the above determinative and written Egyptians. It's relatively difficult to differentiate between the various scepters and the representative officers. However, the glyph is generally understood to represent the Sekhem scepter. Okay, whatever, but its meaning is this. The Sekhem scepter denotes the concept of power and might. The word Sekhem could also refer to divine beings, and even the stars as powers. The name of the warlike goddess Sekhemet means mighty one. The god Osiris was often called the great Sekhem, or foremost of powers. Therefore, the Sekhem was often used as a symbol of the underworld deity, due to its association with the underworld god. The scepter also became an emblem of another mortuary god, Anubis. The scepter was often shown with the reconciling god, as shown above. So, even the very base level of all this stuff keeps going back to these underworld mighty ones in this one. I mean, it seems to me that all of Egyptian thought is, from my limited understanding of it, keeps going back to this issue. Now I really didn't intend to spend as much time on it. I actually just started looking up more stuff as I got to doing this, but I just wanted to sort of put out a semi, you know, just a theory about it. And I think that it's possible that a lot of, this is my opinion of why people get sucked into a lot of stuff by trying to figure out what the pyramids are, like I did. Like this guy that I work across the way with, he's an older guy, and he just really is into the pyramids. He was just telling me about this new DVD that he's got, and he told me who was in it. It was like Graham Hancock and, you know, Robert Bouval and all these, like, just rogues list of guys that I absolutely know 100% are deceiving people. And it's all with the same sort of line, which is, the ancient Egyptians had some sort of secret knowledge that you too can have as long as you just look for the secret power of the pyramids. And that's what I think they want people to do, is to look for the source of the power of what the pyramids are about. And let me just tell you how dangerous that could be. Now, Manly P. Hall, some of you will recognize that name. Manly P. Hall is an very serious occultist. He's a Satanist. The reason he wasn't a Mason or anything, but he was given all the degrees of Masonry because he figured out their secret. The same reason that Helena Blavatsky and Aleister Crowley also were similarly given all the degrees and medals of Masonry without ever actually going through any of the initiations, because they came to the same conclusions independently of it, which was that they all worshipped Lucifer. So that's basically all the step-by-step stuff that Masonry does. It takes you on one step and you go to another step, all getting you ready to do this one thing, which is worship Lucifer, to actually, you know, and so they already figured that out. So of course, to keep them from writing about it, they just initiated them. Now, what we're going to look at here is some writings of Manly P. Hall. Okay, so this is called The Initiation of the Pyramid. And first he goes into this just lauding descriptions of the pyramid and how wonderful of a civilization and how they're so deserving of our worship and stuff. And he talks about Herodotus and gives Herodotus's account of how the pyramids were built. He makes known that he doesn't think Herodotus is, he thinks he's somewhat imaginative in this description of how they were built, because obviously Manly P. Hall thinks it they were done in some mystical way or whatever. So this is what he says after that. While his account is extremely colorful, it is apparent that the father of history, for reasons which he doubtless considered sufficient, concocted a fraudulent story to conceal the true origin and purpose of the Great Pyramid. This is but one of several instances in his writings which would lead the thoughtful reader to suspect that Herodotus himself was an initiate of the sacred schools and consequently obliged to preserve inviolate the secrets of the ancient orders. The theory advantaged by Herodotus, and now generally accepted that the pyramid was a tomb of the pharaoh Cheops, cannot be substantiated. In fact, Manetho, Aristothenes, and Diodorus Siculus all differ from Herodotus, as well as from each other, regarding the name of the builder of the supreme edifice. Scooping around here, he also says, as much as the most eminent authorities on the subject are still uncertain as to the true meaning of the crude markings, whatever proof they might be that the building was erected during the Fourth Dynasty is certainly offset by the seashells at the base of the pyramid, which Mr. Gabb advances as evidence that it was erected before the deluge, a theory substantiated by the much-abused Arabian traditions. One Arabian historian declared that the pyramid was built by the Egyptian sages as a refuge against the flood, while others Another proclaimed it to have been the treasure house of powerful antediluvian King Shedadad ben Ad. Okay, I'm going to skip down here to the part that interests me, which is the initiation part of this. This is something that Manly P. Hall is saying all the great initiates of the mysteries through the ages have had to be initiated within the walls of this great pyramid, where he's about to describe what it is that's happening. And I would say that this echoes, in a lot of ways, the Luciferian initiations that Bill Schneblin and other people have talked about, where they actually kind of go out, whether in their body or out of their body, I don't know, but they go to have an actual meeting with this being who at least calls himself to be Lucifer. There are stories like this all over the place. People that were really, really into the occult describe initiation ceremonies where they actually come face to face with a being in various ways are initiated into this. I don't want to try to drive that home too much, as I just want to just read what he's saying here. Okay, here goes. Through the mystic passageways, the chambers of the Great Pyramid passed the illumined of antiquity. They entered its portals as men, and they came forth as gods. It was the place, of the second birth, the, quote, womb of the mysteries. And wisdom dwelt in it as God dwells in the hearts of men. And that's very blasphemous. But somewhere in the depths of its recesses there resided an unknown being who was called the Initiator, or the Illustrious One, robed in blue and gold and bearing in his hand the sevenfold key of eternity. This was the lion-faced Hierophant, the Holy One, the Master of Masters, who never left the House of Wisdom. Never left the House of Wisdom, and whom no man ever saw, save he who had passed through the gates of preparation and purification. It was in these chambers that Plato, he of the broad brow, came face to face with the wisdom of the ages personified in the Master of the Hidden House. Anyway, he goes on to talk about how this is all accomplished, and I'll skip down here. He says, the king's chamber was enacted, the drama of the second death. Here the candidate, after being crucified upon the cross of solstices and the equinox, was buried in the great coffer. This profound mystery to the atmosphere and temperature of the king's chamber is a particular death-like cold which cuts to the marrow of the bone. So while his body lay in the coffer, the soul of the neophyte soared as a human-headed hawk through the celestial realms, there to discover firsthand the eternity, life, light, and truth, as well as the illusion of death, darkness, and sin. Thus, in this one sense, the Great Pyramid may be likened to a gate through which the ancient priest permitted a few to pass toward attainment of individual completion. It is also to be noted, incidentally, that if the king's coffer of the king's chamber is struck, the sound emitted has no counterpart in the known musical scale. This tonal value may be formed part of the combination of circumstances which rendered the king's chamber an ideal setting for the conferment of highest degree of the mysteries. Okay, I'll try to sum this up, because despite my efforts to try to not make a big deal out of this whole thing, it definitely turned into sort of a long show about it. Here's the deal. I'm not proposing that any particular being or beings are under the pyramid, or any particular ones are in Egypt or anything. I think that the religion of Egyptian religion is best explained by what happened, as is the Greek religion of those gods is best explained by what Enoch was saying. I think that the religions of the world are totally understood with clarity after sort of hearing it just said point by point by Enoch there, and what the Bible is also saying, except the details are kind of filled in. As I mentioned before, none of the doctrines are totally intact. It's just that there's more details, and you can take them with a grain of salt, and I certainly am pleading with you to take them with a grain of salt. And if I haven't made that evident enough throughout this podcast, I'm really trying to. That being said, I think that it also unravels the mystery of things like the Great Pyramid, as I'm not convinced it's definitely what I'm talking about, but I think that it's possible, like, try this on for size, that they were bound in Egypt, The pyramids were put there as some sort of marker. Now, who put those markers there, whether they be the good angels that were told to put the rocks, the jagged rocks, on top of Dudale, that's a possibility. I'm willing to entertain that the pyramids were actually built by the good angels to sort of mark the place where some of them were put. I'm also willing to sort of look at it from the Patrick Heron perspective, which he wrote the book Nephilim, Pyramid, and the Apocalypse, where Nephilim were the ones to build the pyramid, and he has lots of ideas about that, and I essentially agree with just about everything he says. But I want to try to wrap this up and say that the theory that I have is that whether the pyramids are involved at all, I think that the ancient Egyptian people knew about something like this. The underworld, to them, was something that really was happening, that these gods were bound and they couldn't leave, and that it was a good thing that they were bound, and like a good power bound them hand and foot in chains for this particular reason. And I think the deeper you go into Egyptian religion, you'll find that they were even talking about the angels that bound them and the specific jobs that they were having. And if you listen to, you know, Enoch, he's saying, you know, Uriel was over this, and Azazel taught everybody, you know, how to make swords out of bronze, and he's the one that taught them astrology and all these other kinds of stuff. And you see the exact same parallels in Egypt. I mean, they're telling the exact same story, in my opinion. But anyway, I'm going to spend the last 10 minutes, and I'm just going to talk about something besides this, because honestly, the Book of Enoch, when I was reading that, did something far more for me, which was give me reverence for God and prayer and my approaching of the throne of God. It was just so interesting. It's like the scenes in Ezekiel and Revelation and Daniel and some other places where, you know, people are just struck with visions of God, and it's just like, you know, they see the way that the angelic realm reacts to God. It's just this unbelievable reverence for him, and it's just, you get these very vivid pictures of the reverence that God deserves. And so, and for me, it was kind of convicting. It was like, you know, sometimes I take for granted what I have, which is being reconciled to God through Jesus Christ. Having this audience to God, that he loves me and cares about me and is listening to me, is absolutely a privilege to be part of this family. And so I would encourage everyone out there, if they're not, to do so, to be a part of this family through Jesus Christ. And if you don't know who he is, find out, ask God, be like, you know, if Jesus is, you know, something that you want me to know about, you're going to have to tell me, ask the God of the universe if he would be willing to show you who Jesus is and why it matters to you. And he will definitely do that. But what I was going to talk about was, you know, my personal sort of prayer life is just, it's always a struggle. You know, it seems like I know that my days would be totally better if I can just remember to pray and look at every day as a sort of new beginning, you know, a chance to become what you're not through the power of Christ. I mean, there's so many things that I have to be that I'm not, that so many things that I need to become that I'm not. I mean, I have, you know, problems that I just can't do, because mainly because I can't even want to do them. It's like my desire to do them isn't even there. So I need from God not just the ability, but I need the desire. Literally, the only thing that I can bring to this table of these things that have to be done to myself for me to become a better person, the only thing I can bring to the table is prayer, to ask God for those things, to ask him for, like, you know, the desire to pray, to ask him for the motivation to do the things. All I have to do is to ask. I don't have to become those things myself. I just need to remember to ask and to be serious about it. It's really pretty easy. He's doing all the heavy lifting. I just have to do the asking. And even that has become like, oh, that's impossible. But anyway, I wanted to play a clip that doesn't really speak directly to it, but really inspired me because of that.
I am so tired of just doing. So tired of having my Christian life reduced down to how I perform and what I do. Jesus Christ comes to me. His yoke is easy and his burden is light. And he tells me this: it is not what you do, for I can raise up rocks to do what you do and do better than you do. But it is Paul. The seal I have set upon you, the decree and the hope, is that you be conformed to my image. That you be conformed. That is what he desires. And I submit to you today that all the problems, if not all, most of the problems in your life come from who you're not, from your character, who you are as a person. Our squabbles in our marriages come from fleshly outbursts. They come from not reflecting Jesus Christ. The problem between brothers, the problem in life, the problem, the disruption of our own conscience, everything comes down from we're not putting enough emphasis where emphasis belongs, and it is on becoming like Jesus. Everybody wants to do something when we ought to be wanting to be something. Now listen to me. This might set some of you free. Do you ever get up in the morning and you have your quiet time and feel the presence of God and you're studying the Word and God seems to speak to you, and then, you know, you go out and you witness to everybody and you're obedient and boy, you did it right that day. I mean, you were just on top of the world. You loved your wife. You didn't kick the cat. You're walking with God. And you're so full of joy at the end of the day. Then the next day you get up, well, you overslept. You shouldn't have watched that program the night before. You should have been in the Word. You didn't witness when you had an opportunity. And there's a real sense in which you're filled with sorrow. You know what that is? Idolatry. You have become the source of your own joy. Your joy comes from you.
Okay, everyone, I guess that's pretty much the show for today. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to go to Revelations Radio Network, the new site that's there, all the social networking stuff that's available. Also, check out DVD Tract, the new section with the Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormon section there that Derek has done. Go check out, like, click on the headers for most of those things, like, and you'll just be blown away with all the stuff that he's done there. So I guess that's pretty much it, and hope you all have a great rest of the week. Hope to talk to you sooner than later. Don't forget the Frank and Chris show every Wednesday night on TalkShoe.com. You can find the link on Revelations Radio Network, and there it's a 3-hour show where we discuss the news and everything like that every week. So join us there. There's a lot of fun in the chat rooms, people hanging out and stuff. So just join us at the Frank and Chris show and find the link to the talk show every Wednesday night starting at 8 Central, 9 Eastern, and going till, 3 hours from then. So, all right, take it easy. Bye.